time for hour number two of the Bible study, the Ask the Pastor Hour, or as we like to call it when Pastor, Professor, Seminary Teacher Jeff Gibbs is here, Ask the Professor.
Just don't ask him very much.
505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. You call, ask him whatever you want. You got my permission.
Oh, goody.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, Chuck.
So, obviously, the seminary is closed down now for...
Yes, offices are open, I think, today and maybe tomorrow, but classes are on Christmas break, and so the students are, probably working on homework. No, that's not true.
Now, are you on one of those, like, seven-year sabbaticals, or are you actually teaching at the seminary now?
Yeah, no, I'm teaching, and yes, I had a sabbatical last year and for 6 months, a sabbatical from teaching, you know.
Yeah.
Yep, so we're in the middle, kind of in the throes of winter term. And
so if I were in Dr. Gibbs' course in this term, what would I be learning? What are you teaching?
Well, I have a nice array of courses, actually. The normal teaching load is three courses a term, and I'm teaching first-year students in the basic interpretation course, the fancy name for which is biblical hermeneutics, which is not a disease.
Yeah. Sounds like something you need penicillin.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But as I tell them, it's how to carefully and responsibly read the Bible and realize how you're reading it. Okay.
Well, let's stop right there just for a moment. I don't want to get too far off the subject here, but who's to say that the way you interpret the Bible, the hermeneutics, is that what you said, is the right way to do it? I mean, if I want to read it upside down particularly with the book of Revelation that we've been studying, which we seem to be taking the minority view approach on the book of Revelation. Who's to say that you know enough about Bible interpreting to teach pastors how to do it right?
Right, right. Well, two things. One is it depends on prior assumptions about the Bible, right? That is that it is both the Word of God and the Word of human beings. And as such, you take what comes from those assumptions and just, for instance, from the human side of things, you interpret, in that sense, the Bible the way you responsibly read any other written text. So it has sentences, uses your favorite topic, grammar. So, in other words, you don't violate those rules. And from the divine side of things, you conclude, along with many other Christians, that the Bible has a central message, Jesus, right? Promised, fulfilled, coming again. And that because it's authored from God, ultimately it all fits together and it doesn't contradict itself.
So when I get done with Professor Gibbs' hermeneutics class, typical seminarian,
yes,
is my thinking been adjusted, focused a little bit, or am I going, whoa, that is a whole new way of seeing everything? Which of those two is more likely?
Well, probably a combination of both in that, and I told the students in that class, you'll probably come out of this class with more questions than you had going in.
Well, that's not very helpful.
Well, it is because it's at the beginning of the curriculum.
Ah.
So
you get all those answers by the time graduation
rolls
around?
Well, you replace some, right? As we all know in the Christian life in general. You end up getting answers to questions that you used to have, but then new questions pop up, which is just a fancy way of saying we're not God, and we never have it all quite figured out. But it is a course to invite people to think carefully about what we sometimes say very quickly and in a very common sense way. For instance, you're not supposed to take things out of context. I mean, anything. Everything is located in a context, and especially in a written document, whether it's the Bible or the newspaper, right? And that's the human side of Scripture. So it really is a course that raises awareness. We do sort of practice specifically on different kinds of literature that are in the Bible. You know, as you know, the fancy word for this is the different genres. You have poetry, you have parables, you have sort of uniquely visionary documents like Revelation or parts of Daniel or Zechariah and so forth. You have historical narratives like the Gospels or First Kings. So each of those things has to be taken into account. And it's sort of like the opposite of this, of course, is the old joke about the guy who was, you know, Lord, point me to the verse for my life today. And he flops open the Bible, and it comes to Matthew 27, Judas went out and hanged himself, right? And he realized that can't be right, so he flops the Bible open again and points, and again it says,
but Judas hanged himself.
No. Go thou and do likewise.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
Oh, is that what you're teaching down
there? That's right. So that's the first-year course, and then I'm teaching a fourth-year course where it's kind of a big-picture course, actually. Only concluding students take it, where we try to pull the big themes of the Bible together to a certain extent. And then, not surprisingly perhaps, I'm teaching one elective, which is the Gospel of Matthew, which is a lot of fun.
Now, have you finished writing that big, long book yet? I know you got the first half done, right?
Yeah, well, and now it has, that first half has now become the first third.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know.
It means everybody's going to have to spring an extra $40 now.
Blame the people at Concordia Publishing House, specifically Paul McCain, Ed Engelbrecht, and all those good people over there. So just blame them. Call them up and
so the first volume, commentary, Concordia Commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, covers how many chapters?
10.
10 chapters. And the second volume is
10.
Cover 10 and then?
8.
8.
Yeah.
Wow. That's
I probably never would have signed up for it if I'd realized how long this was going to take.
So where are you in that process now?
Chapters 11 through 20 are at Concordia Publishing House and being edited now. Should come out later in 2010, next year.
So for a guy who's got a hermeneutic,
right.
I like to just throw that word
which around. Is like a hitch in your get-along.
Right? Yeah, I got to find a way to throw that out in church somewhere so somebody thinks. Anyway,
right.
But it would seem to me that if you were going to write a commentary on the Gospel of Matthew and you were going to apply a hermeneutic, Scripture interprets Scripture.
Right.
That it would be infinite. That it would be...
Yeah, well, that's the problem. You just have to decide where to stop. And you
where
do have
did you
to,
decide to stop?
Well, yeah.
How did you decide that?
Well, what's helpful is, you know, this commentary series has a particular audience in mind.
Which is?
Theologically interested pastors and adept lay people. Okay.
You imply that there are pastors who are not theologically interested.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
That is correct.
That is correct.
Wouldn't want one of those for your pastor, would you?
I personally wouldn't, no. But they're written at a fairly high level in that they, as you know, make extensive use of Greek and Hebrew in a few Old Testament passages, Aramaic. But they're not just grammar and nitty-gritty technical
stuff.
So
I got no chance, do I?
Actually, you do, because the way they're set up is the commentary volumes each spend some time discussing some of that stuff. But then the commentary sections is more or less just written in English prose, but it's at a fairly high level. A guy like you, and I'm sure you have already, you can pick up a commentary, any of them really, and just with your English Bible, you know, next to you, especially a more literal translation, like maybe the NASB or the King James, New King James, you can follow along. And the commentary sections are written in a way that I think many lay people who, again, are willing to work intellectually and to be challenged, can really appreciate them. So,
see, this is why if I were in your shoes, I wouldn't even begin a project like this, because yeah. I'm the kind of person, unfortunately for me, who would begin a project like that, and I would start by making the notes I need to write about whatever I'm writing about, and as I'm sort of studying that out, I would see something I've never seen before.
Right, right.
And 7 years later, I'd still be thinking about that, and
try 12.
No book would ever get written.
Try 12 years
Has
later.
This happened to you as you are attempting to write this book? You think... You make your outline sort of, here's what you want to do, and as you're writing, you discover something that you didn't know before you agreed to do the project.
Often.
Now, what happens? Because you could say, well, I'm going to have to study this out and use a hermeneutic here of Scripture and interpret Scripture, and the book never gets written because you never stop studying.
Right.
How do you avoid that?
Well, that's you're absolutely right, and... since nobody wants to read that much, and really no one should want to write that much. For me, what's been helpful, Chuck, and this is, in a sense, part of my training is, I think, in terms of trees, forest, and glade. So the trees are very interesting, each one of them. In fact, every branch is interesting, right? But there are a lot of commentaries, actually that are already out there in English that spend a lot of time looking at individual trees and at branches. And then there are other books written that kind of give you the large-scale picture, but my sense is that there aren't a lot of commentaries that give you look at the glade, the grove within the forest. And that's been part of my training, is to try to help place a story like an account when Jesus walks on the water and Peter, you know, comes out and sinks. And now, where does that fit? I mean, first of all, what does it mean about Jesus and about human beings and ultimately about our relationship with Christ? But then how does that fit into the larger message? So again, glades within the forest. So somehow I've come to that picture, and I try to keep that in mind. And if I do that, then I just stop, and then I move on to the next.
How many kids you got?
Four.
Excellent. Four kids. And
six grandchildren.
And if, God bless you.
Thank you. Five born, one unborn.
And, I'm heading that direction here in a second. If somebody were to look at the Gibbs family picture there, they'd probably say, yeah, those are the Gibbs kids. Oh, yeah. And they'd probably all resemble each other in a kind of a Gibbs kind of a way.
Mm-hmm.
But you, as the parent, you're probably aware of distinctions, differences that
right.
nobody else knows.
Right.
And I might look at a family picture and say, yeah, they all look like they belong to Mr. and Mrs. Gibbs. Absolutely. But because you raised them,
mm-hmm.
you're aware of those differences that nobody else will ever know.
Right.
Except maybe down the road, spouses a little bit.
Right.
Having spent all this time with Matthew, I mean, we've got the four Gospels.
Right.
And for the most part, they appear to be quite similar. Oh, that John Gospel, it's a black sheep of the family. It's
yeah.
a little different.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, it describes the crucifixion and the resurrection. It's all there. Is there something about Matthew that you can tell me? Like you could describe one of you, like your oldest child.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
here's
mm-hmm.
how my oldest child is doing. I know they all look like they're Gibbs, right. but here's how the oldest child. Oh, it's just completely different than the other three. Can you tell me something about the Gospel of Matthew from that perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's not a bad analogy because, our oldest, Abby, for instance, has qualities. Now, the other children have them to a certain extent as
mm-hmm.
well, right?
Of course
so
it is.
Family relationship, right?
Right. Siblings.
Yes, I would say that the Gospel of Matthew has this message in a unique way. God works in ways that are the opposite of what we would expect him to. And he gives everything to the people who have and who deserve nothing.
And if I, being the lightweight that I am, were to say, well, you mean Mark doesn't tell us that?
Luke no, doesn't? He does. He does. But when you look at some of the unique stories in Matthew, the very first story after the genealogy, which communicates this in its own way as well, is the story about how Joseph is going to do the wrong thing for the right reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't know what God is up to.
Mm-hmm.
And the Magi show up, right? And they're in the wrong city, right? And what are they doing there anyway? Because they're a bunch of pagan philosophers, you know? Mm-hmm. They're the least people that you would ever expect to show up. Now Luke, you know, just to compare, has a similar kind of a thing, but the way Luke wants us to say that is to say God reverses things. He brings down the mighty from their thrones and exalts those of low degree. The valleys are filled up, the mountains are laid low. See, so is that a different theology or a different teaching about God? No, it's not different, but it's turned a certain way, see? And so...
So, you are telling me this, and I'm thinking, well, that's nice. And I'm ready to move on to something else.
Yeah, yeah.
But, oh, I missed the glade. I missed the glade because, well, I parked myself there for 10 seconds and then I moved
right,
on.
Right.
So since we only have a few minutes here and you can't describe the glade to me fully, explain to me what it is that's precious about what you just said about the Gospel of Matthew that is kind of unique to the mm-hmm. Gospel of Matthew that I can take with me that I otherwise might not have now.
Right. The Gospel of Matthew invites us to stop pretending. To stop pretending that we're in charge. To stop pretending that we're sufficient. To stop pretending that we're strong and that we're capable. All great American virtues, compounded by our cultural myths and promoted by the presence of technology in our lives and the fact that we are the wealthiest country in the world despite the current economy. The Gospel of Matthew invites us to stop pretending that we are wise and strong and in control. Because if you keep going down that road, you're going to find out in a very painful way that you're not. See? Instead, the Gospel of Matthew invites you and me to acknowledge that we are, in fact, poor in spirit. We can't be who we should be. We don't have what it takes. In fact, we need this Jesus who says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for the reign of heaven belongs to them."
Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Leo, you're on the Bible study.
I'm delighted to have a chance to get Professor Gibbs in a corner, because when he was over at Reformation, I used to hound him about Soren Kierkegaard's treatment of that passage in Matthew that said, "Blessed is he whosoever is not offended in me." And you know what he did, Mr. Rathard? He skirted all the way around it and quit right there on volume one. And
yeah.
So I'm going to buy that thing.
You just have to be patient. Be patient.
I'll tell you what, I wanted to ask you also, when you gentlemen do this kind of study, does any reference ever occur to somebody like Lenski? And I want to wish you both a very happy holiday. I'm going to get off.
All right. Thanks for the call. You're going to have to help me out with Kierkegaard and Lenski.
Yeah.
And what is he talking about?
Well, I don't know what Kierkegaard says about Matthew 11, verse 5. And Lenski, of course, refers to that great classic commentary written in the 1920s by R.C.H. Lenski, who taught, I believe, at the old ULCA, United Lutheran Church of America, I think, seminary in Columbus, Ohio. Right? It's still printed today.
Mm-hmm.
It was the last major commentary on Matthew written in English by a conservative Lutheran. It's interesting. So, on the assumption that I am a conservative Lutheran, the current project is 85 years later. Blessed is the one who has not caused to stumble because of me, is Matthew 11:5. It comes after John asks Jesus, "Are you the coming one, or shall we look for another?" Right? And the problem with John is that, and this relates to the theme that I mentioned before, that is, when God acts in the world in Jesus, it doesn't end up looking like what you thought it might. And for John, it looks like the four walls of a prison cell and an axe coming down to take his head off. So John wants to know, are you really God at work in the world to save us? And Jesus' answer is, yes, I am. But you'll have to be willing to accept me on my own terms. And that is, following me will involve cross-bearing and suffering, which is not the way I would have done the reign of God. You know, the reign of God, you would think, would be a little more impressive than this. It wouldn't necessarily end up with a cross, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is the way God's decided to do it. So, blessed, in fact, saved, now and forever, is the one who has not caused to stumble because of me.
All right. Leo, I hope that answers your question. Now, you have an event coming up in January, do you not, here
yes.
at the seminary?
Yes, at the end of January.
What do you know the date off the top of your head?
It's the last Saturday, which I believe is the 30th. Is that correct?
I'll check my calendar.
Is the 30th of Saturday?
While you tell us what it is that you're going to be doing.
Yes, it's a Saturday workshop that we've done, I think, about five or six times now, called Making Abortion Unthinkable. And I moderate it and lead the discussion.
Unthinkable?
Yes.
Was there a pause in the middle of that word for a reason?
Indeed. It's an invitation to really people who are already by conviction pro-life, that is, who think that abortion is actually the wrongful taking of an innocent human
life.
No
pro-choicers invited?
Well, they could come, but they would be frustrated, I think, because we're just going to assume
that they're wrong.
Yeah. Although the focus of the workshop is sort of clear definitions, what abortion really refers to. It's actually a four-step argument that is so clear I can tell you what it is. There's the need to restore the meaning of the word abortion. There's the need to offer sound scientific evidence and sound moral reasoning that would appeal even to a non-Christian. Right? And finally, there's the need to give reasonable responses to pro-choice rhetoric. So it's a four-part presentation. We register at 8:30 in the morning, and we end promptly at 2:30, no exceptions, because I believe in ending on time. And so it's a whole curriculum in about one day, and there's a wonderful workbook that actually has everything in it, so you don't have to write everything down. And I think to register, it's on the seminary webpage. It's $12, which includes lunch and the workbook. So it's actually a very, very, very fine curriculum that I've done a number of times, Making Abortion Unthinkable.
So how is it that you, and your wife for that matter, have risen to prominence in the seminary community here on pro-life questions? Is this an avocation for you, or you just happen to be well-informed on this and the seminary asked you to do it? How did you come to this point?
Well, I personally came to it by marrying my wife. Now, that happened a long time ago.
Yeah. She straightened you out, did she?
She's in the process, yes, indeed. I'd like to think it's mutual. Long ago, there was a student and his wife. The student's name was Steve Reardon, and Steve and Sharon were members of a congregation here in St. Louis, and they had been active in pro-life matters here in the St. Louis area. And what happened was that Sharon had gotten into the calling of going down to pray at the Planned Parenthood clinic during what a friend of ours likes to call killing hours, that is, when abortions are being performed, and to sort of kindly and gently offer support and alternative to women as they go in. And Sharon would go down there with many very faithful Roman Catholic Christians. And she just invited Renee to go down with her. Like most conservative Lutherans, we've always thought pro-life and spoken pro-life. But Renee went down there with Sharon to the Planned Parenthood Clinic, and I don't know how many years that's been. Now, it must be about 10 or 15 years ago. And that was kind of a step forward for Renee in terms of her involvement in activism. And then it just sort of gradually happened for us. And, it just seems like a very important thing to do. The church needs to speak not just on behalf of the children who are unborn, but on behalf of those for whom it's too late.
It just seems to me, that the rhetoric these days on questions like this is more, the arguments are more ad hominem than than ever.
Yes.
I mean, it's like through the roof, it seems to me.
Right.
So that if you say, well, I have a pro-life position, and my wife has a pro-life position, and we're going to do this little one-day seminar, and with the emphasis on think in the context of unthinkable, and your opponent will just say, well, you just hate women. You just want to enslave women. So it's not really about thinking about the question of whether abortion is appropriate or not. It's just suddenly about you.
Right.
You just hate women.
Correct.
And therefore, you can be dismissed. We're not going to talk about it anymore.
Right.
We'll get to the other side of the break. I'd like for you to explain how you work through that.
Right.
And also, I have some audio that I want to play. Actually, it's a video, but you'll hear the audio of one of these stings done at Planned Parenthood up in Appleton, Wisconsin. Did you
right.
hear about that?
I did, yes.
I'm going to play a little audio from that, get your reaction to that.
Sure.
Professor Jeff Gibbs is with us, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Roland. Next time in Studio A, we'll be joined by Dr. Victor Raj. He's going to help us answer some very important questions for this Christmas time, such as, who is Jesus Christ? How do you know that Jesus Christ is true God? All these are wrapped up in this thing we call the Creed, and we're going to look at the second part of three next time in Studio A.
Weekdays at 4 on KFUO Radio.
The Magical Music of Disney is a concert of symphonic arrangements from the Walt Disney Studio Archives, performed live by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, directed by David Robertson. It'll be synchronized with images from Disney's The Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, Mary Poppins, Tarzan, and more on the screen at Powell Symphony Hall. The Magical Music of Disney is Saturday, January 2nd, and children age 3 and over are most welcome. Reserve your seats today by calling the Powell Symphony Hall box office.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
And the angel said unto them, fear not, for behold, I bring you tidings of great joy which shall be to all people. What kind of Christmas memories do these words stir in your heart? Maybe it's the Charlie Brown Christmas special. Maybe you recall as a child memorizing those lines for the Christmas Eve service. Most likely, your memories warm your heart. But thousands of brave soldiers will only have their memories to keep them warm this year. They may be in a dangerous and desolate Afghanistan location where the glitter and trimmings of Christmas is the last thing they'll see. Please keep these soldiers and the people back home who love them in your prayers this Christmas. They're why we can publicly celebrate the birth of our Savior without fear, and why we can tell everyone about Jesus our Savior without worry about what our political adversaries will do.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Last Wishes. I'm Steve Coleman with today's Religion Roundup. Evangelist Oral Roberts has been remembered as a charismatic preacher, healer, and visionary. Thousands packed an arena at Oral Roberts University Monday for a service that Roberts' daughter said was just what he wanted.
He used to say, y'all don't have to have a funeral for me because the news media have already preached my funeral many times. So we're going to have a memorial service. That's why we're doing this. We're celebrating today.
Oral Roberts died last week at the age of 91. Israeli archaeologists say they've uncovered the first dwelling in Nazareth that can be dated back to the time of Jesus, when Nazareth probably had only about 50 houses populated by poor Jews. Archaeologist Yardina Alexandra of the Israel Antiquities Authority says,
this would be the sort of house that Jesus or people of his period would have lived in.
She says it's likely Jesus and his childhood friends would have known the house. I'm Steve Coleman.
I'm Diane. I hope you're enjoying the sounds of the season from 1 to 4 p.m. weekdays. The essence of the afternoon includes some holiday favorites from some of your favorite Christian artists and helpful conversation from Dr. Jane Fryer, Carol Walther, and Jan Wendorf. Music and conversation, some tea and sympathy as you continue to circle the mall parking lot looking for that one open spot. The essence of the afternoon on KFUO Radio. Soon, it will be Christmas Day.
During the holidays, let's not forget the elderly and children who could be freezing. This is Reverend Earl Nance Jr. here, reminding you that every red cent you give helps Heat Up St. Louis. Please use our secure website, heatupstlouis.org. For 10 years, we've helped 190,000 stay safe and warm. Our charity does not receive federal help. We depend on your generosity. It's heatupstlouis.org. Thank you.
Joseph of the Bible Study, Professor Jeff Gibbs is here, professor at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, also the author of at least one-third of the Matthew commentary for Concordia Publishing House. 505-780-5180-730-2727, actually two-thirds. Second third is coming out. It's like you got to think of it in hockey terms. They divide their games into three periods.
Yeah, or maybe like Rocky 5 or Rocky 12 or something.
So here's my question for you. Because you've been here before. Anybody who's heard you on our program knows that you're an intelligent and articulate guy. People can detect that by listening to how you talk and what you say. Now you're going to do a seminar on January 30th. That is the last Saturday in January. Looked at the calendar. And you're going to make the case for the pro-life position with people mm-hmm. who come to the seminar. These days, it seems to me that if you're a pro-lifer, for example,
mm-hmm.
and you advance the argument of the pro-life position, somebody who is pro-choice will say, well, you just hate women. You just want women to be second-class citizens, barefoot and pregnant. And then we tend to say, well, no, that's not right. And all of a sudden, I'm defending why I don't hate women
right.
instead of him defending why he thinks we should be able to kill unborn children.
Right.
And it happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you end up talking past each other.
Well, you're not talking at all because the pro-choicer says victory.
Right.
Walks away, and he has not defended or she has not defended why it ought to be correct or right or moral to kill unborn children. We never even get to that point, let alone talking past each other.
Right, right.
Now, do you have advice for people so that when the argument is turned back or changed, how to say, wait a minute, that's not, we can talk about that point later.
Right.
But right now, I need you to defend why you think killing a child in the womb is okay. Have you got a plan or a strategy?
Yes, you can. Again, this is the first step in this workshop, actually. You can try to restore the meaning of the word abortion. Because...
What is the meaning now from which it needs to be restored?
Well, the meaning now tends to be it's about women. Now, are women involved? Of course they're involved, right? It tends to be about poverty. It tends to be about every child a wanted child, which, again, is more about us and about what we want.
The wanters.
Yeah, exactly. So one way to do that is to say something like this. Well, what actually happens when an abortion takes place? See, because that's what we are talking about, at least initially. Or at least if you'd like to talk about abortion, let's talk about what happens every single time. No
exceptions.
Did you
ever ask that question?
Yeah.
Because, see, that's the question right there that usually doesn't get asked.
I know,
for the reasons I just cited. So on the occasions when you've asked that question
right.
of a pro-choice proponent, what do they say?
Well, often people don't want to talk about it, which shows the limits, actually, of the unthinkable. I mean, this is a very logical, reasonable, calm discussion, but it's a very difficult topic about which to have calm, reasonable, respectful conversation. But if you can invite the person to say, well, okay, let's talk about that. What does actually happen when every single time an abortion takes place?
Oh, why would you want to talk about that? That's so grisly. You want to, is that what they say?
Well, again...
It's unfortunate. I admit it's unfortunate, but why would you want to talk about that?
Right, right. And the answer is because that's actually the issue at hand. These other issues, poverty, women's rights, abusive husbands, these are all important topics. And see, that's part of the mistake that pro-lifers sometimes make is they go, that stuff doesn't matter. Well, as a matter of fact, it does matter. These are important topics, see? But we're not talking about women's rights in general. We're not talking about misogyny in general. We're not talking about how parents should love their children in general. The issue that we're trying to speak here is the issue of abortion. And so we need to start by being clear, if we can, without yelling, about what actually happens when an abortion takes place. And what happens is that something living, notice how I'm speaking very vaguely now, mm-hmm. something living is killed. Okay?
Can't argue with that.
Yeah, I don't think so. Now, here's an illustration to show the importance of answering the question, well, what is it that's being killed? Here's a little illustration for you. You're standing at the sink in the kitchen, and your child or nephew or grandchild is about 4 years old, 5 years old, comes up behind you, and you're doing the dishes. And the child from behind you says, can I kill this? What's the first question you're going to ask?
Well, what is it that you
want
to
kill? Well, what is it? You know, if it's your favorite cockroach, go for it, you know. If it's the funny-looking kid down the street, we need to have a conversation, see. So the necessary response to the question, can I kill this, is, what is it? See? And that's the question that actually is often overlooked, or the question is assumed to have an answer, but that's the question when it comes to the issue of abortion.
Well,
what is it?
That's a perfect setup for this audio that I'd like to listen to. And
yeah.
I apologize to people beforehand and to you, Professor, if it's not all clear along the way.
Sure.
It is part of a video. You will hear the person who produced this interject during the course of this live video. But what they did was they took a hidden camera into
yeah.
an abortion clinic, a Planned Parenthood clinic in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And they pretended as if they were looking to get an abortion
right.
in order to see how the nurse and the doctor would respond.
Right.
And they have that, and it is now on YouTube, which pro-choicers probably think is unfortunate.
Right.
But the record is clear. Now, we're going to begin here with the woman who has come to the clinic, and she's dealing with one of the nurses. And she says to the nurse, well, can I talk to the doctor? And that's where we pick up the audio.
Do you think I can talk to the doctor first?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Doctor? Let's talk to you first.
Yeah. Okay.
Like before we do, could the lady tell me that I could talk to you first, like what the procedures were?
I'm going to go over that with you since I do the exam.
Okay, I can't do it before?
Mm-hmm.
You can't even talk first?
Yeah, go ahead. What do you want to ask?
Like, what comes out? Is it?
The pregnancy is going to be removed.
Okay.
Placenta and the fetus.
What's the fetus?
The fetus is the is the embryo that's developing inside.
Okay. What embryo?
Well, that's the pregnancy. That's, you know, there's something growing inside your uterus, and it's called a fetus.
Okay.
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 It's not a baby at this stage or anything like that.
Oh. When does it become a baby?
Well, when you're like 7 months pregnant or so, 6-7 months pregnant.
They are really trying to increase.
It's at that point, I hope you're able to pick that up.
Yeah,
were you able
to
discern
yeah.
enough out of that?
Right.
The conversation, you know, can I talk to the doctor first? And so the doctor comes in. Now,
right. If
the things that you have asserted so far are true, this is an awkward moment for the doctor, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yes.
And the woman says, the other lady told me that I could talk to you first, like what the procedures were. The doctor says, I'm going to go over that with you as soon as I do the exam.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds to me like you're intruding here in territory that you ordinarily would not be in because I'm a busy guy.
Right.
She says, I can't do it before. And then the doctor concedes and says, well, yes. He says, what do you want to do? Well, can't we talk first, she says. He says, yeah, go ahead. What do you want to ask? She says, like, what comes out?
Mm-hmm.
Is it? And he interrupts, and she says, the doctor says, the pregnancy is going to be removed.
Right.
Now, this is the what is it?
It is the what is it question. Yes, indeed.
And
yes.
These are the answers. The pregnancy is going to be removed, the placenta and the fetus. She says, what's a fetus? And this is the part that I would like you to focus on. He says, the fetus is the develop, and then he stops.
Yeah.
And catches himself.
Right.
What was he going to say?
I don't know.
What do you think he was going to say?
The developing child.
Or baby.
Yeah.
But he catches himself, and he says, is the embryo that's developing inside.
Mm-hmm.
So, what were your thoughts as you were listening to this doctor answer the what is it question?
Well, he probably was caught off guard, you sensed a kind of an awkwardness in his voice, because it's hard to be a reasonable person and not come to some fairly obvious conclusions. He's a medical doctor. He knows all the genetics. He knows
the science.
Yeah, he knows the science, the basic science of when a unique human genetic code is formed and, you know, how quickly you get brain waves and all that kind of stuff, heartbeat. And so I heard a person maybe even within himself trying to avoid saying the obvious, if I can just say it that way. I mean, I don't know this man. I don't want to say anything about him that I wouldn't know to be true, but it sounded like someone who was trying to avoid saying the obvious.
Well, here's what he did say. It's not a baby at this stage.
And then she asked,
anything like that. And she says, when does it become a baby?
Right.
He says, now remember, he knows the science.
Right, right.
When you're like 7 months pregnant or so, mm-hmm. 6-7 months pregnant.
Right.
Right now you're just a little more than 2 months. Well, what's your response to that claim? After all, he is a scientist and you're just a theologian.
He's relying on the legal, probably on the legal definition of viability, the current definition of viability, that it's a baby when it's viable.
Well, is that true?
It's hard to find any sort of coherent rationale for calling it a human being, that is to say a baby. One day before it's viable, it's not, and a day after it's viable, it is a child. My father went through a period about 3 years ago when he wasn't viable.
Yeah.
He was on life support, you know, intubated and that kind of thing. So that's a pretty slippery slope on which to judge whether or not a life is a human being. So
she has one that's 8 weeks along, apparently.
Yeah, right.
Is it a baby?
It is a developing human being, right? Just as you and I are developing.
Was that a no? It's not a baby?
It is a human life. It is a complete, within itself, very young human life, right? I would call it a baby, but I'm trying to be sort of careful here in how I use terms, because most people would agree that it's wrong to deliberately kill an innocent human being, right? And this is an innocent human being. It's a very young one. It's a very small one. But if people would agree to that basic moral proposition, then it's hard to avoid the conclusion that abortion takes the life of innocent human beings. They're just very small.
If he were here with us, listening to his own remarks and your response to that, he would be in a bit of a difficult position.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever put somebody, a pro-choice advocate, into that difficult position, you one-on-one with somebody?
I haven't had as much experience with that as Renee. My wife actually has. And she actually, Renee is very good. Part of it is because she's such a sweet person, you know. But she's pretty good at inviting people to try to think clearly and to not change the subject and so forth. And what happens is that people, she's had, again, some experience even down at the Planned Parenthood Clinic trying to reasonably, kindly talk to pro-choice people, not yell at them, right, not be angry and to give into that way of thinking and reacting. People actually have said to her, well, you've given me something to think about, see? And in a sense, on this level, that's all we can do. That's all we can do is try to clarify what's going on to try to show them that their current moral thinking is untenable. But the problem is that we're not all, none of us is sort of completely consistent in our thinking. And to move someone, it's a great sea change just because the power of our culture, the power of the rhetoric that's involved.
I'm a pretty simple thinker, which in some ways works in my favor, because I don't have to work very hard to look at the facts. You have human parents. The life in the mother is from human parents.
Right.
And when it emerges, it is, for all to see, a human being.
Right.
So how it might be something other than that in between its conception and its birth.
Right, right.
Well, that's just not all that hard for me to figure out.
Right.
It's obviously a developing human being.
Right.
Obviously.
Right.
So that when someone comes along and feels the need to argue against that,
mm-hmm.
well, I find that to be quite remarkable. I find it to be a curiosity as to, well, how are you going to make your way through those hoops?
Right.
This might be an interesting thing to watch. Now, I want to play a little bit more audio here.
Sure.
From this encounter between this young woman and this doctor and see if that can't shed some light on that question. Let's listen.
Right, because the sooner you do an abortion, the easier it is and the quicker it is.
Okay. What's the farthest I can do it?
Here? Or 13 weeks.
13?
But in the state here, you can have an abortion up to maybe 22 weeks or so. But you don't want to do that.
Why?
Well, because it's a lot harder for you. It's more expensive, a lot more difficult.
Okay.
This is very safe. The stage you're at right now is very, very safe. Safer than having a baby, actually.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So?
Much safer than having a baby. You know, women die having babies.
Mm-hmm. Do women die with abortions?
Yes, but it's never happened to me. And I've been doing them for 40 years.
Comment?
Well, again, he's begging the question. He's refusing to talk about what the child actually is now. To be honest, I'm surprised he admitted that women have died, undergoing abortion procedures, which is a fact. There has been several here in the St. Louis area in recent years. He's sort of intent on. He's intent on moving forward as if this were not a human being. This may sound weird. At least he seems to be speaking kindly. Sometimes pro-life people paint pro-choice people as like evil through and through and cruel and only in it for the money. And I think that's a mistake. I mean, I think we need to realize that pro-choice people are just regular people. And they can be very compassionate about many things, and they might make just jolly good neighbors, you know. They're not like Snidely Whiplash chuckling in their beer, and cheap beer at that.
There is a difference between evil and misguided.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, to demonize people on the other side of this incredibly important moral issue is not a good idea. I need to say it that way.
However.
But see, that's ad hominem. That's not what we're talking about.
We did have this woman who came out who was involved in the administration of a Planned Parenthood clinic.
Yeah,
it was Planned Parenthood.
Yes, in Texas, I think. Yeah,
and she has, for lack of a better term, repented.
Right.
She's done a 180.
Right.
And she is now saying that what she witnessed there and what is done there is morally wrong.
Yes.
And she offers an explanation for why it is happening.
Right.
And that is that she, as an administrator, was under pressure to generate revenue.
Sure, sure.
More abortions,
right.
More money.
Planned Parenthood is a business.
And this doctor who's saying, well, you know, it's safer to do it now, less questions you got to answer, less
right.
expensive, you
right.
know.
Right,
sounds to me like a guy who's trying to sell an abortion.
Right. Because we've stopped talking about what it actually is. See, that's the point, is that they're no longer talking about what is going to happen. He's moved past that. He said, it's not a baby. Well, if it's not a baby, as they say in this workshop, if an abortion does not take the life of an innocent human being, then no rationale for it is necessary. It's like having your appendix out, see? On the other hand, if it is taking the innocent life of a human being, then no rationalization for it is sufficient.
You know, there was actually a time when they used to make the argument that it is like having your appendix taken
right.
out.
Right.
They don't make that argument anymore.
No.
Because
no.
they rolled it. Well, they rolled it out there, and it didn't work.
Right.
Everybody said, well, that's obviously not true.
Right. So, again, they've stopped talking. Now they're talking about economics. They're talking about which is an issue. Does economics count for something? Yes.
Sure.
They're talking about safety of the mother. Does that count for something?
Sure.
Yes. Okay. But again, we're not talking about how to keep mothers safe or women's health in general. We're not talking about economics in general. We're talking about an abortion. And the most important question to talk about is it? What happens? So
this is going to be a weak analogy, but I'm going to use it with an assumption. Let's just say at the conclusion of the three-volume Concordia commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, that the crowning achievement of your career as a pastor and as a professor, and you are enriched by it. You become a fairly wealthy man with this crowning achievement. The reason he's laughing is because, as I pointed out, this is a weak analogy, but
yes.
This man says in this video, it's never happened to me. That is, nobody's ever died under my knife.
Right.
And I've been doing them for 40 years.
I know.
How many babies die over the course of a 40-year career?
Mm-hmm.
What is it about 40 years of abortions that would get you to keep coming back if it's not the fact that it's a lucrative business?
I don't know. There's
money to be made.
Yeah.
Enough money maybe to be made that would cause you to say something like, well, 4 months, it's not a baby.
Yeah.
Because if somebody says that to me, I say, well, you're nuts. You're crazy.
Right.
Well, of course it's a baby.
Right.
What would cause you to say something like that? Could it be money?
It could be. But again, I would be slow to attribute any particular motive to any particular person on the abortion side of things. See, that's the same kind of ad hominem argument.
Maybe, maybe not.
That they accuse the pro-life people of. So, since I can't know...
It's not ad hominem in the case of the administrator who just admitted factually that the pressure...
Right.
...is to generate more revenue.
Right. Well, aren't businesses, Chuck, supposed to make money?
Absolutely. That's not ad hominem. That's just normal business practice.
Right. Again,
the business here just happens to be killing babies.
But, yes, and so that's what we need to be talking about, rather than the evil motives of the people involved. Because sometimes you'll be right, and sometimes you'll be wrong. See, to be honest, I'm fairly impressed with the kind of the patient tone of voice of this doctor.
Mm-hmm.
See, and he's answering questions. Well, kind of answering questions. He slid past the most important one and refused to answer it. But you see,
you are a much finer person than I, sir, because I am such a cynic. To me, he sounds like a guy who's trying to not blow the sail.
Yeah.
That's what he sounds like to me.
Right. And to a pro-choice person, you sound like a redneck that just hates women. Yeah. No, I'm quite serious. Yeah. So
I know.
And that's why it's funny when I teach this workshop, you know, which is a very fine workshop, and I would actually recommend it. I came to it by being married to Renee. She wanted it to get offered, and I said, okay, I'll do it. And I was just dragging my feet. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to happen on a Saturday. And so Thursday night, Chuck, I start previewing the material.
Yeah.
And it just carried me along. I thought to myself, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen of this kind. And it's actually, I'll give a plug here, it's from our friends, our evangelical friends at Stand to Reason.
Okay, sure.
You know about their work.
Absolutely.
And it's one of their curricula. It's Greg Kuchel and Scott Klusendorf is who it is.
Don't want to argue with those guys.
No, I mean, these guys are great guys. And so it's their curriculum, and I moderate it and lead the discussion and that kind of thing. So
when is it again? One more.
Well, it's called Making Abortion Unthinkable. It's 8:30 registration. On Saturday the 30th here at Concordia Seminary. It's on our website, www.csl.edu, and you can email our continuing ed office and register that way. I think walk-ins are okay, but we'd like to know how many people are coming. $12. If you're a seminary community person, like a student or a spouse, it's free.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Am I a seminary community person?
I'll split it with you.
Twist some arms on that.
50-50 on that one, Chuck. Yeah.
That is Dr. Jeff Gibbs, Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. That's our Ask the Pastor program. Tomorrow we continue in Revelation 14 with Pastor Mark Hawkinson.
Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.